We're shifting things profoundly.
Rebecca Solnit, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Her new book is called Men Explain Things to Me, and that does it for the show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Dina Guzdar. Special happy birthday to Mike DeFilippo. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Mate.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8 o'clock. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with our hosts Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. Today we'll talk about the proposed new rating system for higher education under consideration by our president.
May 31st at the Star Theater, join Green Empowerment and 300 sustainability movers and shakers for the second annual Passport to Empowerment Benefit Party to raise money for renewable energy and water projects in remote villages. DJ Anjali, Love Bomb Go-Go, and their 17-piece marching band, Filipino tinikling stick dancers, an airless performance, and food and cocktails from Nicaragua, Philippines, and Malaysia. Tickets are available at greenempowerment.org/passport. Passport to Empowerment is May 31st at the Star Theater. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Thank you, baby. Just wanna take a little time out. Do you? Thank you, baby.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Oh, wait. Thank you.
Thank you for contributing to KBOO's membership drive. It was a success, and we couldn't have done it without you.
Thank you for your post, for your like, for your click.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members in a grant from the Aladdin Theater, presenting Moody Blues guitarist Justin Hayward with Mike Dawes Tuesday, June 10th. Tickets and information for Justin Hayward, June 10th at Aladdin-Theater.com.
We don't need no thought control. No dark sarcasm in the classroom. Teacher, leave them kids alone.
Brick.
Brick.
Wall.
If you don't eat your meat, you can't have any pudding.
No pudding.
I guess meat and pudding were fixtures in the British school experience.
If you were lucky.
If our large sample size of one Pink Floyd song is any indication.
Well, of course, we can trust Pink Floyd to be, statistically accurate.
Yeah. The first concert I ever went to, Pink Floyd, 1987.
You're so young.
I know. It was a great show.
The first concert I ever went to was at the... I can't remember, but it was Earl Bostick.
I don't know who that is.
It was a saxophone player.
Heard the name.
Saxophone player, very influential among musicians, and popular for a time in the early 50s. He played a music that kind of combined rhythm and blues sound with jazz. And he was sort of an in-between those two places guy.
I think later generations called that rock and roll.
No.
Oh.
No, it's nothing like rock and roll. Rock and roll is, never mind. Okay. Okay, we're going to talk about, well, first of all, we're going to tell people this is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. This is KVOO 90.7 on your FM dial. That's Abe Proctor. I'm Joe Uris. We're going to talk about education, particularly higher education. And I'm going to remind people they can call us at 231-8187.
They can. College is getting really expensive, really expensive.
Really expensive. Is it worth it?
Well, that's what a lot of people are asking themselves. I think the answer to that is still yes, but the cost, as we just mentioned, in many ways, is really escalating.
Well, not to mention the possibility, if you're a woman, of getting shot by some insane dude.
Well, yeah, there's that.
That ups the cost a lot, I obviously. Think. It makes it problematic. That.
Yeah, and it's clear now, the reason it's still worth it is that most jobs of note these days require at least some post-secondary education. Even if you're, I shouldn't say even if, and that includes vocational types of occupations.
Yeah, let's talk about this historically. First of all, until after World War II, very few people actually went to even state schools, and certainly very few went to the private elite schools, the Ivy Leagues and Stanford and places like that. And what happened that really changed things was World War II. World War II included something called the GI Bill,
yes,
which allowed men who came back from the trauma of war to go to college. And they had two things going for them. One, not so good, which is the trauma of the experience of war. But the other was a very serious sense of personal obligation, a sense of personal direction, not necessarily a career direction, but a citizenship direction. They really felt like they were part of the society. And this also was a continuation of the attitudes engendered by the effort to recover from the Great Depression. We don't have anything like that now.
No.
Nothing.
No, we don't. Oh, we should, though, point out at this point that, yes, the GI Bill was a wonderful thing, but it largely excluded soldiers of color.
Right.
They didn't get to share in that post-war bounty.
Is that legally right or just the way it worked?
Well, I imagine that. I imagine probably both. I don't. I'm speculating here, but I would wager that there was not language in the GI Bill specifically indicating that all sorts of soldiers were to be included.
So entitlement would just go to the edge of your skin color.
The edge of your skin color. The same with Veterans Administration loans, which helped a lot of those GIs get set up with their first home.
In fact, we've discovered as we do research that black farmers in the West and the South, and in even New England, were not treated equally in the various farm bills that were put together to help farmers recover from the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression, too.
Right.
So we have this history, which is shouldn't surprise many people. We have this history of negative impacts of segregation.
Indeed.
During that time. But that's not our topic.
No.
I want to talk a little bit about my experience in higher education and just kind of outline a little bit of that, if that's all right.
That's fine. I think we should set that up very quickly.
You want to set that up very quickly?
Yes.
How quickly
because
you want to set that up?
This on this show, many times we've talked about the massive public investment that happened in this country in the post-war era,
yes.
Specifically the first three post-war decades.
Right.
There was a massive, by today's standards, massive government spending on all sorts of things that benefited the large middle class of Americans.
Including the GI bills covering the payments for houses.
Right. And including the construction of university campuses all over the place.
Right.
In fact, leading to the system, the higher education system, probably the only phase of our education system in which we are still superior to the rest of the developed world, we created a university system that was the envy of the world.
Well, yes and no. It's certainly the case that in Europe, the universities are harder to get into, more elitist, but they're free.
Yeah, and there's fewer of them, though, is what I'm saying.
Very much fewer, and the competition is enormous to get into the right schools.
So anyway, let's talk about your college experience.
Oh, yeah.
At least the part you can remember.
Me. Yeah, the part I can remember because, what are you saying?
Nothing.
Because,
nothing.
You know, anyway, first of all, I didn't know nothing. I came out of San Diego, out of a high school that was basically not a college-bound population. High school that was half white at entrance, which was sophomore year, as the first year of high school in San Diego. half white, half Chicano, I mean quarter Chicano and a quarter black. By the time we finished, most of the students were white, so we had this huge dropout rate of persons of color. That's one thing to consider. Also, I rarely took classes which were, in fact, integrated, even though the school was. And I had, and I was unusual in this, some friends who were Mexican-American and some friends who were African-American. But that was unusual. That was not common. And where it mostly happened was in sports, actually.
It's a great democratizer.
Yeah, right. Football. Bash your head. Anyway, in that environment, most of the teachers were not very good. In that environment, I'm not sure. What I learned, I think, mostly was through the influence of others and through reading and not school itself. But when I got done, when I was finishing, I decided to go to Reed College here in Portland, which is how I came to be in Portland, which was, I was told, you know, it's really a great school. And some people said, oh, no, it's all gay. Which wasn't a word then, or it's all communist, which was a word then, and I was kind of hoping it was communist. my prejudices as an 18-year-old were really strong and very limited, though I thought I was a great liberal kind of guy.
So you're hoping it was communist and not gay?
Kind of.
All right.
It was not a big thought, but a minor thought of the time. Turned out to be not much of either. At any rate, I went to Reed for 2 years. And it was an incredibly liberating experience. And I took some classes that were wonderful, and I didn't do well in a lot of the classes because I was having the discovery of myself and my world and all kinds of stuff that was enormously liberating. And there were great teachers, really great teachers. I think of Lloyd Reynolds, who taught an art history course. It was just marvelous. He'd been almost red-baited out of Reed, but had survived that. All these great people, most of them very conservative, who taught there. Now, that's a very elite school. More so today than then, because then I think tuition was something like $1,250 a year, which even by today's money standards is very cheap. And I could work and go to school. And it was those 2 years that I went to Reed were incredibly instructive. And I read an enormous amount of material well beyond what was required in the courses. In fact, frequently I didn't read what was in the courses. I read other stuff. Now, after that 2 years, I went to work as a window display designer for Meyer and Frank.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So Reed kind of was gay. No, I'm kidding. I kid.
Whoa, that is really, we're going to hear from people on that one.
Sure we will.
Yes, right, go ahead. And well, we should. Okay. Anyway, I did the window display thing, and then I got a chance to go to school in New York, and I went to Columbia University. And I did organizing for the Student Peace Union, and I worked with the Catholic Worker Movement, and War Resisters League, and a bunch of other things like that. Mm-hmm. And CORE. I worked as an organizer and a trainer for CORE. I did all this stuff, and it was great. And I learned an enormous amount of material. I came back here, and after a while, I went to school at Portland State. And I had a very successful career there.
Yeah.
I did well.
This is grad school at this point?
No.
No?
This is my point. It's still undergraduate.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
I'm already way past the time when I should have graduated.
Uh-huh.
And I went to Portland State, and I did a bunch of stuff. I ended up, by some accident of something, I ended up president of the student body there. I ended up getting able to...
by some accident?
Well, some foolishness on my part. Anyway, and I ended up with a bunch of power in the sense of money.
Mm-hmm.
And we put on the first big successful dances of the kind of psychedelic type.
Mm-hmm.
During that time, we brought in all kinds of speakers, Stokely Carmichael. We brought in Allen Ginsberg, Timothy Leary, who's a real jerk. But I didn't know that then. And I took LSD with Timothy Leary.
No kidding.
What a jerk. Okay. Yeah. Anyway, so I went through all that.
What a time to realize what a jerk he is.
Yeah, and then at the end of 67, I was out of school. I had graduated. I went to Europe, my partner and I, and we did a bunch of different stuff. I came back, I did a little social work, and I went to graduate school, which was just starting up at Portland State. After a period of time, I got a master's degree,
mm-hmm.
and then a PhD.
I see.
All of that.
And you entered a career in teaching, in academia.
I did. And all of that took, and I drove buses, and I did all kinds of work in the interim. And I ended up in 81 with a PhD, and I ended up eventually earning a decent living and teaching large numbers of people and learning from them and having a great experience, a really great experience, and then retiring. And it was all good, all good. That couldn't happen today, I don't think.
So let's summarize here. So you took way too long to get your...
No, not too long.
Baccalaureate degree.
Just right.
Just right. Longer than most to get your baccalaureate degree. Then you went to grad school, and now you are an ivory tower communist, American-hating elitist professor.
I don't know about the ivory tower.
Okay.
The rest of it, sure.
Okay.
Oh, you bet.
So you've never really held a real job or worked an honest living a day in your life.
Well, see, that's totally untrue. I mean, all I did, limited amount of scholarships, but all I did and fellowships was basically work, just various jobs.
Sure, right. The kind of work you do when you're going to school. Right.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, for the most part.
For the most part.
But you go ahead, please.
Well, I remember when I first went back to graduate school, this was brand new. Portland State was just becoming a real university. I was in the sociology department. I got an assistantship, and I went to meet my professor, who was a guy named Wilson Record, who was an expert on race relations at the time. And he wanted me, what he wanted me to do was go down, hang out in the cafeteria and spy on the black students.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, he wanted me to spy on the black students. So I came back to the chair of the department, a guy named Charles Bolton, who I really respect, and said, hey, I can't do this. I'm going to have to, you know, I can't do this. I can't do what he wants. And he said, well, you don't get to choose who you work under. And I said, well, then I guess I have to pass on it. And he said, well, what's the, you know, why? I said, this guy wants me to spy on the black students. I said, I'm not going to do that. So he found me another person to work under. And that was the beginning of, not for me, but for the whole culture, the beginning of the real rebellion against the war in Vietnam. A real anger that combined with anger over the failure of the society to live up to the promise of the Voter Act and all the other things that were going to create equality for persons of color. Now, all of that, during all of that, I read vociferously in all kinds of areas. I had an incredibly good, I think, education.
Sure.
And it was all possible because it really wasn't that expensive because I was poor.
Sure, as are a lot of college students.
Now, today that couldn't happen.
No, it would be a hell of a lot more difficult, or it would require a massive amount of indebtedness, which I gather you largely avoided.
Never had school debt.
God, that's brilliant.
I mean, never. I mean,
wow.
It was fellowships. It was scholarships. It was fellowships. It was it was work. You know, paying the way. I also had a partner who worked. That was good.
Sure. Okay. So your point is very well taken, that you were able to do all this and attain the education that you did and go on to impart that education to lots, thousands, literally
of
other
yeah.
Americans. And you were able to do so without crushing indebtedness. And that is most definitely not the case today.
Right.
And I think we should also look at the fact that our national priorities have shifted such that it used to be a priority of the highest order to ensure that, A, we had world-class higher education facilities and faculty and staff, and that those facilities were available to pretty much anyone at a relatively low cost. And that is not a national priority today.
No, and it's not the case at all. I mean, no. University of California was, I can't remember, very little.
My dad went there when it was free.
Yeah, it was not quite free because there was a student body fee.
Well, you had to pay fees, but the tuition wasn't.
Right. Well, it was virtually free, and it was a period of time in which you saw a radicalization of a relatively privileged class of upper level working class people who went to college, middle class people who went to college, and so on. And at the same time, there was an awareness of the political the disturbing political trends in America toward what today I call friendly fascism.
So let me ask you this. Was it not for the fact that we managed to create the first mass-educated middle class in human history? Mm-hmm. Was it an accident then that that mass-educated middle class became aware of the political problems? Do you think there was a that those two things coincided?
I do. I do think they coincided. I don't think they're necessary. I don't think it's a necessary precondition, but I think it's a significant condition.
So my follow-up then is, if the mass education of the American middle class enabled this section of the populace to come to grips with these political trends and move against them, mm-hmm. do you think that the ruling class since then has worked to ensure that we never again have a cheaply mass-educated middle class in this country?
Short answer, yes.
Ah,
I truly
that
believe,
it's too dangerous.
I'm not a conspiracist, but I truly believe that there was a decision being made, particularly during the Reagan era, to limit education and to target it. Suddenly, colleges and universities, rather than becoming places of liberal arts education, mm-hmm. where you learned a lot about a little, or little mm-hmm. about a lot, suddenly you had to learn a lot about a very little.
You had to become a specialist.
You became a specialist, and essentially university became a vocational school.
And you became a specialist in a technical discipline, or you really couldn't count on that good middle-class living
right.
that a college degree used to guarantee.
Right. And all the forces in the society having to do with what a person 18 or so would do aligned against taking a slow, learned path to enlightenment, as it were. It all I'm not going to call it enlightenment, that's, you know, but to education. And I think that that is not an accident. I think that it serves the interests of a ruling class that doesn't want people to know what the hell's going on, that really limits intelligence and intellect and development thereof, and that sees everybody as only successful if they can earn a certain kind of income doing certain kinds of work under certain kinds of conditions, ideally without labor unions, ideally without representation on any level, in fields that are highly technical.
And as Noam Chomsky points out, if your college-educated class graduates with a high level of indebtedness, they are much less likely to challenge the system in which they find themselves, because all of a sudden their first obligation is to deal with that indebtedness.
Right. Now, along comes Obama. Obama, who for many of us, because we were naive and because I think we had a kind of positive racism, actually, saw him as a salvation, a significant figure in our culture, the first black president. Turns out that that's true. But that everything just about that he's done since being elected president has been reactionary, just about everything. Few exceptions, a bad health care program, which is better than nothing, is the only thing I can think of that specifically he's done to improve things. There are other small accomplishments. I don't want people to call us to say Obama's cool. That's not my point. Or he's not cool. That is not my focus, and I don't think yours either. But one of the things that's happening right now, and this is the front page of the New York Times today, or yesterday, what's happening right now is that the Obama administration is trying to develop questionnaires and investigations that would create a government list of schools that are worthy of students who get federal grants.
A ranking of
all of the university, all the community colleges, the colleges and the universities. And the basis of this ranking is not educational greatness. It's not, you know, what you learn. It's how quickly you graduate and how quickly you get a good job.
Hmm.
And basically, that's it.
So education has ceased to be an end in itself and is now a means to various levels of income.
Exactly. It's an instrumentalization.
Well, a cynic might argue that thus it has always been.
Well, thus it has always been, in fact. It is, in fact, education is one of the roots out of poverty and out of working class kind of mundane jobs. That's still true. But the direction, the force, the energy that will be put in if the government gets to make its list of desirable schools based purely on how quickly you get through it and how good the job is you get after it, will essentially really punish people who are going to school to learn, who are taking the time. Already that's hard to do because the tuitions is so much higher, the cost of living is so much higher, the possibilities of being a starving student are so much less.
We should probably note that this is KBOO 90.7 FM.
We should.
The
we
Abe
should.
And Joe Talk radio program.
And we should probably have some calls. 231-8187.
Yes, that is indeed the number to call.
So the question is, the issue is, the Obama administration definitely, Department of Education definitely intends to compile a list of all the schools, community colleges, all the way through universities, all the way through elite schools like Harvard or Stanford or Reed, and essentially, based on how quickly people finish that schooling and how well paid they are, what kind of jobs they end up with, decide which schools are the ones that the government will give you grants for. And that's really the plan.
Now, to play devil's advocate for just a moment, the administration is ostensibly doing these things, taking these steps to try and make college more affordable to the average student.
How does it do that?
I really don't know. It seems yet another watered-down sort of scattershot approach. Here's a summation. This is put out by the White House website, whitehouse.gov. This would tie financial aid to college performance, and these ratings are part of that. So schools are going to receive more federal block grants, I presume, for the student aid based on how well they perform in these new rankings, which, as you mentioned, seem to be geared solely toward moving people to a graduated employment situation of some kind.
Well, it's a vocationalization of the entire academic process. And I believe that there really ought to be a time in a person's youth when they gather as much information about as many things as possible, where they perfect their writing skills, they perfect a number of skills, and numeracy, all that stuff. And that amount of time is an indeterminate amount of time, essentially a bargain between what one can afford, what one can hustle up, and what can be given to one through scholarships and so on.
And these ratings, it would seem, wouldn't always, I think, accurately represent what various types of schools are doing and what various types of students are doing at those various types of schools. For example, a rating system that is based on student completion, for example, might shortchange the community college system, where not every student goes there with the intention of earning a degree. A lot of community college students go for professional development to pick up a course here and there, or they look to earn a certificate in some sort of trade or other. They're not necessarily degree completing students. Does that make what they do any less valuable? No, I don't think it does.
Well, in fact, I had it my last before retirement full-time job was working with the community colleges and Portland State University to create a net work, an interchange such that a student could work seamlessly from one kind of school to another. We discovered by looking at data that people will go to the university, then to the community college, then to work, then to the school, then so on. And I think we're 17 different possibilities at that point. And we realized that making the system open made real sense. Making the libraries available at Portland State, for example, to community college students, just a simple example, would improve the education of both groups. And it was really an important strategy. Most people who go to college, who are working people and get the chance to go, their best strategy at this time, I think, is to go to 2 years of community college. You're not going to get a great education in terms of the depth of education you get at a place like Reed, but you can, and then for the next 2 years, go to the university system. It's the cheapest way in the public system.
True. All right, so looking at this plan put out by the administration, again, you can find this on whitehouse.gov. One of the prominent bullet points is ensuring that student debt remains affordable, but they don't they don't offer any prescription for actually lowering the cost of tuition,
no,
either at public or private institutions. What they do is they're calling to cap the proportion of one's income that one must pay towards student loans after you graduate and after you're working. So they're saying, well, you're still going to amass all this debt, but what we're going to do is make sure that you don't have to spend too much of your take-home pay servicing your student debt. And that just doesn't seem adequate to me. I'd much rather see something like what Senator Elizabeth Warren is calling for, which is charging to students the same subprime mortgage rate that banks are charged.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is less than 1%. And her logic on that is, well, you know, if we can afford to charge this rate to banks, we can certainly afford to charge it to students.
Well, it's not a question to afford. This is a policy decision, as you suggest, that produces conservatism in a graduating group of university.
Well, certainly
students.
Does. Yes. Yeah. If you're graduating essentially indentured to the debt that put you through school, you are much less likely to use your newfound position in society, your presumably newfound wealth, at least relative to the time you entered school. You're much less likely to use these things to significantly change your society one way or another. In other words, you're not going to see something like the student uprisings of the 1960s. And I submit, again, that is by design.
I think it is. I think it is. I think there's not been enough scholarly work to prove our point.
No.
But I think it's true. I also think that one of the things that happens is, for example, let's say you finish medical school. Very expensive. Now you're ready to practice medicine, but you have a debt that's enormous. You can't go and work in a rural community where there's no doctor.
No.
There's no money for that. They can't afford it. Yeah. The people you're going to treat can't afford it. So you don't do that.
You can't work for Doctors Without Borders.
Exactly. Well, you'd have to, but only if you had the money.
Right.
Which is
or while you're in medical school, you realize the astronomical debt that's mounting, and you decide that your only route is to go into a very highly paid specialization.
Specialty. Right.
Yeah. Which, again, doesn't serve the broader populace.
And the
well.
Same is true for lawyers or teachers. You have to seek a job, practically speaking, under this system, which will repay your debt quickly.
Right.
So that automatically puts you in terms of economics, into a conservative mode. Let's go to the phones. 231-8187.
Harvey, good morning.
Hi there. Well, you guys are great.
Thank you.
You are so great. You are right on topic. And I believe America's number one resource is its educated minds. We have choices here. Is it education or incarceration? Is it education or more war? We spend about half of our gross national product, over half, I think, on the military-industrial complex. I'm sure even a small amount of that could straighten out our education system. And the investment in America is, as far as I'm concerned, the only investment, because, you know, maybe the guy who would have invented some cure for cancer ends up working in McDonald's because he doesn't have access to financing. Maybe the rich guy's son, maybe he's stupid, and because there's money there, he ends up with a degree like George Bush. But
right, and eventually.
Wait a minute!
Wait,
you saying George Bush was stupid?
So we have to essentially use our tax dollars and not give our education system to the financial companies, who reap the profits, but we take the losses because of the diminished education system that they have to offer. And I feel that there's parts of the world now, like in India and China, that their education system is so much better than ours that they're zooming ahead of us. And our education system is, I think they want the television, you know, to be the education system where you go out and eat Doritos and buy cars and everything like that. That's what they want you to learn. And then
you don't like Doritos? What?
Well, it's like a system where we end up obese, being wheelchaired around in cars, and it's kind of it doesn't serve us. It just really doesn't serve us. And so I feel that you guys are the beginning of a better education system, and I want to see our tax dollars essentially produce education, because when debt, that's like we've created a sort of a company store thing where they're enslaved with the money, and then for the rest of their life they're a working slave because you can't get from under the debt.
No, you're absolutely right, and I want to thank you for the call. I want to give others a chance, and I also want to comment on this pattern. I think it's real. I mean, I think it's intentional. I think there is a real disallowing of what we used to be calling liberal arts education. People can finish college without any without any knowledge of the classics, without any knowledge of the cultures and traditions and history of the world, without enormous amounts of what I consider to be the bulk of the knowledge of humankind.
And, yeah, and I think therein lies the biggest danger here. We are, and one could credibly argue that we're already there, creating a society of technocrats, specialized technocrats, without that broad grasp of the larger arc of human history. And when that happens, we can't connect these historical threads that run not only through the history of our country, but the larger history of the entire species. Now, can someone who is very narrowly educated in the classics and in history and in philosophy and so on, is somebody like that going to identify closely with the Enlightenment values that spawned the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States, for example?
I think not. Yeah, no, I think this is a crisis. I don't know enough about what's going on in Europe right now. I know European education, and I know private school education in the United States, by and large, including the Catholic schools, by the way, have always maintained the tradition of the liberal arts. I know that those are considered, therefore, a luxury of those who can afford private education. Public education, in general, varies a lot. There are elitist schools within public education, but fewer and fewer of them, and more of them emphasizing technical skills.
Yeah.
So computer skills, computational skills, mm-hmm. stuff like that. And I'm very distressed about this, and I see the pattern becoming more and more clear. It's like the science fiction that I used to read when I was in young adolescence. It's like that. The futurism is like that. It's like Ray Bradbury and
Heinlein.
Well, he's such a fascist. But 1984 is another example of a book where that's an extreme case. Brave New World is perhaps a more accurate picture of the future.
So all of this part of the general dumbing down of the body politic that's been going on for at least three decades now.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, even when you look at, let's say you like popular music, mm-hmm. you don't know anything about popular music. What popular music is for you, not you, but a person, is something that's happening right now. They have no idea what the origins of that are. They have no idea how it evolved. Most people, for example, I suspect, I don't know this, but I suspect have no idea of the history of jazz, no idea of the impact of African-American culture, and for that matter, the culture of the Scots-Irish on American music. It's just not known.
You might even go so far as to suggest that a populace that is largely ignorant of these larger historical trends might actually believe it when the President of the United States says they hate us for our freedoms.
Exactly. And let's go to the phones again. 231-8187.
Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, gentlemen. For once, I find myself calling to affirm everything you're saying.
Yay! Oh, my gosh!
Yeah, well, normally I agree with you, Professor, but actually, in some ways, I have kind of an interesting perspective to offer on this.
Okay.
I am a soon-to-graduate technocrat at age 60. I'm going to be graduating with a degree in computer science with a concentration in security and information assurance.
Aha!
And I rise to defend vociferously a liberal arts education.
Good. Cool.
I've been at this for 4 years now. I just happened to get lucky and be in a position in my mid-50s to go back and finish the degree that I bailed on in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. And like most of my colleagues, when I started this little adventure, I would have grumbled endlessly about, why do I have to take this? Why do I take that? All I want to do is learn about computers. Give me a job. Mm-hmm. At the end of it, I find that probably the greatest, you know, bear in mind, I have learned a whole lot about the trade that I'm going into.
Oh, sure.
The best skills that I have come out of this with, I can write, I can do research, I can think critically to a degree that I never, to a level that I never would have been able to before, even though I was pretty good autodidact before this. Primarily having been an inveterate bibliophage since I was a child, you know. But yeah,
a bibliophage.
It works.
Used to
it
eat
works.
Books.
And
you've
you're
eaten
absolutely
books.
Right that they don't want it to work.
No, I think. You go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead. But you know, I always go back to that one interview that Anastasio Somoza had back in the '70s when some journal asked him to explain the 95% illiteracy rate in his Nicaragua, and he replied, "I don't need educated peasants. I need cattle."
That's
and
really
good.
They
want us to be their cattle.
That's really that really does make it clear, doesn't it? And
yep,
of course, people should know that Somoza was held up by, I mean, supported and created virtually by the CIA. I want to thank you for the call. Give us some others a chance here.
Absolutely.
Hey, thanks a lot. All right, coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Alternative Radio, former investment banker turned journalist Nomi Prinz speaks on the Wall Street White House axis. At 10, Air Cascadia is off today. We'll go straight to Flashpoints, which features a recent speech by Palestinian-American journalist Ali Abu Nima. And we hear the latest podcast from Nora Barrows-Friedman and the Electronic Intifada. At 11 on stage and studio, host Dime Roberts looks at Breaking the Silence, a staged reading of a play about three generations of Japanese Americans, with playwright Nikki Nojima Lewis, actress and dancer Chisao Hata, and actor Larry Toda. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, guest host Tom Kramer interviews painter Lucinda Parker about her work, influences on her work, and her life as an artist in Oregon. All
this and
more.
I went to school with Lucinda Parker at Reed.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Yeah. She's a cool woman. Huh. Very good artist. And Kramer, great artist. Yep. You know, we do such good stuff on this station.
Yeah, we really do.
It's underappreciated.
Yeah, appreciate us, damn
appreciate.
It.
Yeah, appreciate. Not us, the station. All right, who's next? 231-8187.
Ralph, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yeah.
I'm just going to bullet point my way through, and you guys can stop me at any point if you want to
okay.
talk about it. You know, the educational system... has been taken over, quite a number of years ago. Notably, the Rockefeller people took over the Educational Association, and they've been in the process of dumbing us down for decades. I mean, this is pretty well documented. The current situation, you notice that the first scheme, or the scheme before this, was to the housing scheme, which indebted a number of people, which still has people indebted. Blew up, so they had to come up with another way to pry money out of your pockets. And so this whole change to the way you borrow money for education, what they did was they locked in your loan. This is the only type of consumer loan that you cannot get out of. You can't declare bankruptcy. You're indebted to this thing.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about student loans now.
Exactly, student loans. And so then the institutions started raising their tuition, which is something like four times the rate of inflation, maybe even higher now. So it makes no sense the price of tuition has gone up that high. There's no rationale for it other than the fact that they know you can't get out of this. It's a locked system. People are told they have to go to college. And so people aren't going to protest by sacrificing their children. And sitting down and say, hey, we're not going to take any more of this. And as you mentioned already, the internationalization of the world is well underway. And along with that, I don't know if you've seen the progress of robotics in industry, but it's incredible.
Yeah, we won't need people pretty soon.
Yeah, exactly. We don't need people. We certainly don't need a middle class anymore, because the goal of internationalization is not to rise people up, but to put everybody back down to the same level that they are, and then you have this exclusive class that that is running around running everything.
Well, there's one thing I want to point out: the miracle of the success of American capitalism has to do with the fact that we had the cultural wisdom to develop a middle and working class that actually earned a decent living beyond just starvation, which meant that we had people who could buy stuff. The way an economy has to work is it has to have supply, which is making stuff, and demand, which is people buying stuff. And right now, we're seeing it way too much emphasis on supply and way too little emphasis on demand. And that's part of the reason for the depression we're in right now.
Well, exactly. And what most people do, because they're locked in the system and they don't have the broader knowledge to see that they're being enslaved, is that most of all of that buying is done on credit. Now that that credit bubble is just about maxed out, so we're headed for another spillover, which is going to take down, you know, a lot of people. And so taking on debt, student debt, people thinking they should run out and buy a house now because, oh, the market has recovered, is, of course, baloney. And I would caution people to buckle up, because, you know, you can't just keep inflating the bubble forever. And college, the government makes... They're deeply involved in the financing of this.
Oh, absolutely. But, mm-hmm. you know, another factor is that privates, particularly private schools, but also public universities, have spent a fortune on infrastructure. And there is, in many places, particularly in the public sector, a tendency to go online with courses. I know people who are very well-educated professors and teachers who cannot get much work because... courses are available online. People think they're getting the same education from those courses, which they may or may not, as they would get in lectures or small conference courses.
Well, and I'll take one point and I'll get off. Let somebody else make a thing. But, you know, to tie this back to, we're almost back to the Roman circuses. Most states, the highest paid public employee is, who do you think it is?
I have no idea.
The head basketball or football coach.
Oh, right. Of course. Yeah. How silly of me. Okay, thanks a lot,
right,
man.
Bye.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you can earn seven figures as a football coach at a major Division I school.
But then you get to have the experience of having young people bash their brains out.
Well, it's few things more satisfying. It's true.
I can hardly think of anything.
This is KBOO 90.7 FM. 503-231-8187 is the number to call.
We're talking about higher education and education in general, and both of us, I guess, are decrying the fact that we're seeing the loss of liberal arts education and the vocationalization of all higher education.
Marina, good morning. Hello.
Marina.
All right, let's go to Michael.
Hi, Michael.
Good morning, guys.
Hey, I haven't heard from you in a while. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Okay,
so a couple of things. Number one is that I read an article by a university president. And
you shouldn't do that. First of all, you shouldn't do that. That's a very bad thing to do.
What?
I'm just teasing you.
Read an article, you mean?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'll never confess to that again.
Okay.
I read an article by a university president on the topic of why is tuition so high? Because tuition has increased way faster than inflation for like 20, 30 years, and it's just unconscionable. So this guy wrote an article, and it was really kind of this honest, sort of sweet article about, you know, I hate this. I hate having to raise tuition so high. It's bogus. It's horrible. I know it has a bad effect on the students, but we have to do it, he says.
Yeah.
And the reason we have to do it, he says, is that there is so much federal regulation coming down on our heads, and every single one of these things requires us to hire administrators and, you know, chancellors and God knows what. And he said there's just no avoiding it. It's the law, and they have to do it. So that's what this guy said.
And well, I don't know. I mean, that may be true. I don't sense that that's the root cause, the radical cause. I think that there's a lot more going on than that.
Well, I'm just telling you what this...
No, I appreciate it. I think it's a good point.
Who may know what he's talking about. Then the other thing is I have, you know, this whole thing of student debt just infuriates me. These colleges, they take somebody for 4 years. They sign up a kid when they hardly know what they're doing for 4 years, and they sign him up for 4 years for an enormous number that a 17-year-old doesn't even really relate to.
Mm-hmm.
And then they let them do a double major in useless studies and worthless studies. And, you know, you can plug in the real word in front of studies. And then they come out and they can get a job, the same job as a barista they could have gotten out of high school. Plus they have $100,000 of debt, and it's crazy. So my proposal to answer this is that students, if they default on their debt, the debt should be charged back to the college that sold them the worthless degree.
Well, that's an interesting and simple way of dealing with the problem that Obama's trying to solve. I want to thank you for the call, man.
Hey, okay. Thanks very much.
Bye.
Interesting idea, that last one.
Yeah, and he pointed at something, a subtext here that I think we ought to bring out onto the table, and that is that there was a stretch during that post-war period, mm-hmm. those three golden decades we've been talking about.
Oh, golden, were they?
Yeah, that's what. Yeah, sure, why not?
The Cold War was golden? All right, never mind.
No. I'm talking about the period of investment in infrastructure, social stability, education, transportation that typified those decades. Okay.
Yeah.
It used to be that you didn't necessarily have to go to school if you wanted a good middle-class job. There were all sorts of jobs in the manufacturing sector that paid very well, that had good retirement, that had good benefits, and all that stuff.
Mostly, I think, because of the struggles of organized labor in the 30s and 40s.
Well, indeed, yes. But that is no longer the case today.
Right.
So people are, young people are relentlessly hit with the message that, you know, if you want any sort of decent living, you got to go to college. You got to go to college. And thus they step headlong, as Michael just stated, into a massive pool of debt.
And I think this is really important. The education you get is vocational education. And that's the thing that's really bothering me the most. And that's where I began this conversation today. I really believe that in order for democracy to function, people need to know history. They need to know the culture. They need to know the literature. They need to know these things, or they're at the mercy of the propagandistic outfits that make our elections.
Yeah, it's true.
And I
hate us for our freedoms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm very disturbed by this. And I don't think there's many people who have the luxury, and this is a wealthy person's thing, of just going to school to learn stuff.
No.
What I see to some degree is older people returning to school because it's in most states free for older people to sit in on classes and learn the stuff they missed.
Hmm.
But you know, it's really the case that the so-called core curriculum, both the high school, grade school, high school core curriculum, and the curriculum that is generally what you see in college now, it's just not what it ought to be, not what it could be. The other alternative is the European one, where schooling is free, but you have to be a very elite student to get a hold of that learning.
Well, what you get there is a better educated mass of people, but fewer people who attain the higher levels of education.
Well, and there it furthers an elitism, a class elitism in Europe that's pretty harsh.
Well, I would say that ranking all of these colleges and universities in terms of these largely materialistic outcomes is going to create exactly the same kind of system here.
Well, I don't know about that, but I do know that what this is really measuring, the kinds of outcomes it's looking toward, have nothing to do with education, nothing to do with knowledge. They have to do with the vocational process. You take 4 years, ideally 3 years, I think, from the model. You get a degree, you get a job, you earn a good living. That's a success. That school is eligible for a large amount of grants that it can give to students who go there. And that coupled with the tendency toward to online courses and so on, is going to dumb down education, dumb down the university system, and essentially reduce, and this is part of the strategy, the power and the influence of the intelligentsia.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah. It's dangerous. It's dangerous for the ruling class to have a mass-educated middle class.
We don't need no Noam Chomsky.
We don't. No, we certainly don't. And we certainly don't need thousands, if not millions, of Americans in the streets protesting the latest war. We certainly don't need that.
Especially when there's always the latest war.
No, and we certainly don't need people questioning the patriarchy. No, we certainly don't need that.
Right.
And we certainly don't need people running around saying outrageous things like women ought to be treated the same as men.
No, we don't need
that. No, we don't need any of that.
We don't need any of that stuff.
No, and all of that, not all of it, but a great deal of that is a product of an educated society.
You think?
I do.
Okay, let's hear from some more folks. 231-8187, we're talking about higher ed.
John, good morning.
Good morning. You guys make me feel rhetorical. you know, I've noticed that they, whoever they are,
yes, go ahead.
Speakers and writers to go online and put messages up to these kids about, you know, yeah, school's expensive, and but it'll be worth it. It'll build character. And
I don't know about character.
I come back at them with, you know, what society builds character by straddling their young with, well, student loans for one, but then the national debt, failing infrastructure, Social Security that may or may not get.
Oh, no, and, I think, let's be clear. I think Social Security is secure for the foreseeable future. But go ahead.
Well, it's a general point.
Yeah.
I think I'm always actively involved in telling these young people that I think they just should flat out boycott universities.
And, wow.
But I also think that the 4 years of college, the first 4 years, that should be high school.
So you would essentially say that everything that is learned as liberal arts education should be embedded in the high school curriculum rather than the college curriculum.
Yeah.
Ah, that's an interesting idea. But
I think they're capable of it.
You know, my father's generation, including my father, never finished high school. I mean, that was relatively elite in and of itself in a long time ago. So
when was the last time you talked to a high school student?
The last time, I don't know, a couple, 3 days ago.
Well, I mean,
but we weren't having a serious conversation. We were just talking.
Oh.
Okay.
You know, they're bored out of their minds.
No, they're not. I have a son who's graduating from high school this next week, and he has not been bored out of his mind. But he has also related to me a culture in which math and science attainment have been drilled into his head at the expense of things like learning literature and history and philosophy and so on.
Yeah, and I think that this is a lot of our point. My faith in liberal arts education, my faith in knowledge of history, of literature, and so on, has to do with the creation of a society where, in fact, people can really think about things and not just take what is there as what is. My model of fictional model of this in terms of science fiction is the work of Ray Bradbury, who talked about a society which burned books. Which systematically, in Fahrenheit 451 and other work, which systematically destroyed the literature of the culture because it had no relevance to the technological future. Anyway, think on that. Let's go to the phones again. 231-8187.
Real quick.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Oh, do you also think that there's a possibility that these institutions, I mean, they've attained what they went after? And they're comfortable, and they're making lots of money, and the way things are inflating to maintain that level of comfort, mm-hmm. they don't want to give it up. They don't want to be uncomfortable.
Well, you got to make a distinction between the workers in the university system or the community college system, which earn a living, but are not super well paid in most, except the most elite schools. That's number one. The people who make the big money in higher education are administrators, and whether they're worth that kind of money, it's another question entirely. I mean, I profited by that, but I'm not sure it was such a smart thing for the schools. Anyway, let's go to some other callers.
Harry, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. I'm also a Portland State University alumni, class of 1985.
Congratulations.
And my first year, well, I had to take out a loan. It took me 5 years to pay it back.
Wow.
My daughter, on the other hand, my two daughters, well, one, it took 10 years to pay it back.
Whoa.
And my second daughter, 25.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
$30,000 in debt.
Ooh.
Thank God she works for Boeing.
Ah.
but I mean, that's what we have to go through is, I think what Obama's doing is, by checking all these schools is, I think he's planning to close some of these schools. There's too many colleges and universities. So I think that he's ranking them so they've been closed. Remember what happened to the car dealers during the Great Recession?
Oh, I see what you're saying.
So it's a good possibility he'd be closing them.
Well, we've run out of time. Sometime we'll talk about healthcare and the creation of the whole system of medical education. We're out of time for Abe and myself. I want to wish you well, urge you to stay tuned to KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial, and stick with us all the time, and certainly next Tuesday.
Thanks. We'll see you next week.
Exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Take a little time out. Thank you, baby.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Oh, wait. Thank you.
Thank you for contributing to KBOO's membership drive. It was a success, and we couldn't have done it without you.
Thank you for your post, for your like, for your click.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide, committed to promoting a progressive regional committed to promoting progressive regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability, localism, and social justice. Complete business directory and resource guide at redirectguide.com. Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First on alternative radio, former investment banker turned journalist Nomi Prinz speaks on the Wall Street White House axis. At 10, Air Cascadia is off today. We'll go straight to Flashpoints, which features a recent speech given by Palestinian-American journalist Ali Abu Nima. And we hear the latest podcast from Nora Barrows Friedman and the Electronic Intifada. At 11 on Stage and Studio, host Dime Roberts looks at Breaking the Silence, a staged reading of a play about three generations of Japanese Americans, with play